Hi, this is Jill Schlesinger, CBS News business analyst, certified financial planner, and the host of the Jill on Money podcast. This is the show where your money is not scary. It's a show that's all about you. It's your questions that make it possible for me to provide unconventional and entertaining insights on your money, and more importantly, on your life. Listen and follow Jill on Money on the Odyssey app or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to 97.1 FM Talk. We're glad that you're here right now. There's one thing that I continue to hear, and it's a political ping pong ball, and none of it really addresses the actual problem at hand. And it really comes down to, are there starving people in Israel? Are there starving people in Gaza? And who's responsible for it? So we're going to ask our friend Jim Carafano about that, the senior counselor to the president and E.W. Richardson Fellow for International Engagement at the Heritage Foundation on X at JJ Carafano, a must follow. Jim, welcome back. Good to have you.
Yeah, so look, I've pretty much conclude. Look, I really think there's only one path forward in Gaza, and that is the relief efforts and humanitarian efforts in Gaza have to be controlled by the Israelis. But between Israel and the United States, there's plenty of capacity to provide adequate care for the people. And it's the only, I think, way that it systematically and humanitarily can happen. And that means, really, I think Hamas just has to be kind of pushed out of the way. And as you know, the primary objective for the United States and Israel is getting a hostage back. And I just think they're gonna have to mount operations to go in and look for and find these people. And I think they're going to do that. I think eventually Israel is going to have to take control of all of Gaza. And they're going to have to structure the humanitarian aid. And then out of this, there has to be a governance structure that evolves in Gaza that doesn't include Hamas. And I don't know how long that takes or how that process happens. But, you know, when there's only one realistic path forward, I think that's the path you got to go on.
Jim Carafano speaking with us right now. You know, there is a visual element that goes along with the starvation, right, and the destruction that has taken place in Gaza. And of course, there's political capital made in whose fault it is. But what is really going on right now? Because we see the aid coming into Gaza. Who's sending it and why isn't it getting to the people?
Well, I mean, you have the UN. But again, they want to distribute aid through Hamas. The problem is when you distribute
the UN
aid
does?
Through Hamas. Yes. The problem is when you want to do that, you are reinforcing the rule of people that created this crisis to begin with, and people who are going to put a primacy on using the aid to maintain their control and power, not to feed the people. So it's just not a rational alternative. And the reality is, at the end of the day, the U.S. and Israel, they hold all the cards here. And all this articles and tweeting and, you know, it can't match the ability of the United States and Israel to really govern events on the ground. And they're just going to have to do that. And they will, because look, the Israelis don't want the last thing the Israelis want is for the people of Gaza to starve to death. It doesn't serve their purposes. And it certainly doesn't serve America's purpose, but if you go to the doctor and the doctor says you have cancer and a brain tumor, you know, which one you want me to cure, but they're both going to kill you. Your answer is, well, doc, you got to do both. So you can't make this a choice between Gaza and starvation because you got to do both. You have to address the issue of humanitarian aid, and you can't let Gaza regain control of, the Hamas regain control of Gaza. That's, you got to do both, because if you can't do both, you're just dying of one thing or the other.
We're speaking with Jim Carafano right now. So what I hear you saying is the UN is providing relief and aid to the people of Gaza, and it's going through Hamas. Is Hamas keeping it from the Palestinians in Gaza?
Because remember, if Hamas cared about the people of Gaza, they would have done October 7th. But once the war started, they would have stopped the war immediately, because the number one victims. So they obviously don't care about the people in Gaza. Otherwise, they wouldn't have got their buildings destroyed, their people displaced and living in tent cities. So obviously Gaza doesn't care about that. you know, it's like going to Hannibal Lecter and, you know, asking him to run the local Weight Watchers. I mean, that's just not going to work.
Jim Carafano speaking with us right now. Let me ask you this, just from the historical records that we have here of Hamas controlling Gaza. It's a more of a Palestinian region, of course. Tell me about Hamas's willingness to let Palestinians and Israelis coexist in the Gaza area. And tell me in comparison about, does Israel have the ability to live in a coexistence with Palestinians in Israel? Are they welcome there? Can they participate in that lifestyle?
Absolutely. Matter of fact, the whole reason why October 7th happened, because Israel adopted a conscious policy of allowing Gazans to come and work with Israel, trying to create this bridge of interdependence, which would eventually kind of put this all away. And Hamas did October 7th, not just to stop that, but you have to remember, the reason why Hamas is in power is because it was a platform for Iran to attack and harass Israel. And so, again, it's, you know, people say this is the Gaza, the people in Gaza versus Israel, and it's really not. It's Hamas, which is really an agent of Iran, and the last thing they have an interest. Now, people say, well, but people voted for these guys. Well, yeah, they did, but they didn't vote for them to destroy their entire life. And I think, you know, it's one of these things, if Hamas was gone, I think most Gazans would say, okay, you know, maybe, hopefully the next guys will be better.
We're speaking with Jim Carafano. I want to shift gears a little bit because there is a news headline out, and this is not something that we normally traditionally hear about from the president of the United States. Fox News reports that President Donald Trump recently broke with decades of strategic silence when he publicly revealed the repositioning of United States nuclear-powered submarines in a thinly veiled warning to Russia.
Yeah.
We got that headline, it was a few days ago maybe, that these submarines had been repositioned there in the Russia vicinity. What's going on?
Right. Well, first of all, we already have submarines that were covering the Russian threat. So, and you don't have to position submarines there in order to threaten Russia. So it is clearly a political statement, and it's really to counter a political statement to, because before the Russians would say all these incredibly crazy threatening things, and Biden would say, oh my God, you know, we have to self-deter, and what Trump is saying is, I'm not playing that game. You want to say scary, horrible things. Don't think that I'm going to back down or pause. I'm going to do exactly what I'm telling you I'm going to do. And so the submarines are designed to really put political pressure on the Russians to convince them how serious Trump is. It has nothing to do with elevated security threats or just going to nuclear war, because none of it is. It is for show, but it's an important. It's an important kind of show. It's an important statement from Donald Trump saying, I don't really care about your hollow, empty threats that scare Joe Biden. They're not going to scare me.
Yeah. And I guess the comments that he's making doesn't cost America anything. It's a way to send a message and to do so in a minimal cost to this country. Do you feel as though, I mean, we're all sitting here kind of on the edge of our seats waiting for President Trump to, like, solve the Russia situation. Is that a solvable problem?
Well, look, I mean, the president's goal is to get to a ceasefire. The only person that can get to a ceasefire is the Russians. But Putin, I don't think we can ever create conditions to force Russia to the table. He might come to the table and do a deal, but we can't force him to do that. But I think what Donald Trump has signaled is we are going to protect our interests. Our interest is a free and independent Ukraine. We can do that in a way that is not going to escalate into World War III or put American boots on the ground or unduly threaten American national security. I think he's convinced Americans of that. So I think he has all the political support in the world he needs. So the biggest loser here is Putin. Putin is never going to get what he wants, ever. And we are going to prevent that at a very kind of reasonable, responsible cost to us. So really kudos to the president. And most of Americans are with him. I mean, it's like 80% of Republicans support the president. You know, I would say just generally across the board, he's probably got 80-90% of Americans on his side on the course of action that he's chosen, which is exactly what you want. You want the president to do reasonable, responsible things. And the president's kind of demonstrated by asking for the ceasefire, you know, giving the Russians a chance, you know, getting the Ukrainians to be reasonable. He's kind of checked all the blocks, I think, for most Americans. And so I think U.S. policy in Europe's in a good, solid place.
Jim, we appreciate you being with us this afternoon, and there's always lots to talk about. We look forward to having you back next week. Thank
you
for your time.
You may appreciate me, but not as much as I appreciate the Annie Fry Show. All right.
That guy didn't. That guy seems to have a problem with me. Jim, thank you so much. Good to talk to you.
Bye-bye.
Bye. That was Ryan Wiggins standing outside waiting to honk the horn after Jim Carafano gets done with his interview. I mean, it's everywhere. All right, let's take a break. When we come back, we are going to get to the YouTube live chat poll for today. Do you believe everyday environmental toxins are taking years off of your life? Yes or no? Yesterday, we had Kong Dao on the show, and we were discussing inflammation, which is a word that I keep hearing everywhere. Inflammation this, inflammation that. And how impactful it is to your overall health. And then today, I heard Dr. Siegel on Fox News this morning talking about microplastics. And I know I'm listening to this stuff and I'm like, gosh, I know just enough to be terrified by everything. Do you think that everyday environmental toxins in your food, in the plastic containers that you use, everything, everywhere, are they taking years off of your life? Yes or no? Annie Fry YouTube channel, your thoughts on what you're looking for. Like I said, my eyes are wide open. I want to know what you know. We'll be right back. All you do is just treat me cold. Ain't gonna take it.
Hi, this is Jill Schlesinger, CBS News business analyst, certified financial planner, and the host of the Jill on Money podcast. This is the show where your money is not scary. It's a show that's all about you. It's your questions that make it possible for me to provide unconventional and entertaining insights on your money and, more importantly, on your life. Listen and follow Jill on Money on the Odyssey app or wherever you get your podcasts.
Is Green Day like the beginning of punk?
No, yeah. They're the end of punk.
Yeah.
I'd say the beginning of punk is probably the mid-70s with Sex Pistols and Ramones and stuff.
You would call that punk? I would call that rock. I guess I don't know what I'm talking
early
about.
Early punk.
They're kind of, Green Day's kind of getting into the emo phase.
Oh, no.
Yeah. No, I would agree.
Emo is, Green Day, emo was just so self-pity.
Oh, it was terrible.
Punk, to me, is, maybe it's more punk pop, if you want to pull, because I would say what you're talking about is punk rock, but I would lean heavily into the rock part of it. Maybe Green Day comes into punk pop, but emo is just so barf.
Yeah.
I'm trying to think if there's an emo band that I enjoy.
Man.
Blink 182.
No, they're not emo.
They would be considered the very, very beginnings. Mm-hmm. I wouldn't put them in emo though.
No way.
That would be
that's like the meanest thing you could say to people who like Blink 182.
I agree. But that was the era that spawned emo. Mm-hmm. Was right after that.
Because it was the popular music of the time. Uh-huh. But it's not emo.
Would you call Papa Roach emo?
I wouldn't even call him punk. I don't even know where
that. Are we in the same universe?
Where do we come out
right
with Papa Roach?
What are you talking about?
Like Papa Roach was like their biggest song was about self harm.
Well, I don't think that's the themes. Emo.
Yeah, it's more of a look.
That's not what emo is.
Yeah, I didn't consider Papa Roach to be a part of it.
I mean, if it's a look, then absolutely Green Day led into Blink 182, which led into emo.
Well, I'm actually agreeing with that, though. But that doesn't mean that
I
put...
it's not like a hard break.
Yeah, yeah. I wouldn't put Blink 182 in the emo category.
What about Avril Lavigne?
No.
She's borderline.
She's the popular version of punk.
That's true.
Pop. Like, we grew up in the golden age of punk pop and hip-hop pop. Hip-hop became popular and punk became popular. But the idea that, like, emo was kind of the leftovers. Like, wait, don't you still feel sorry for me? No, we're doing techno music now again.
What even is popular emo? I can't say what that is.
It's not. It's just whiny.
But is there anybody that sticks out to you that you're like, oh, that song or that band represents emo?
Sum 41 was kind of an afterthought of Blink 182, and it kind of went a little bit further in that direction. But there is a difference between being alternative and, you know, the studs on the, like, did you have a white belt, ladies? Did you wear your white belt with your low-rise jeans, with your thong? You know, that's what people did. Did you show your midriff? I mean, everything Britney Spears wore was like the lowest of low-rise jeans and a little crop top. Now we wear high-rise jeans, mom jeans, high-waisted jeans, and crop tops. But the idea of like dark, like heavy eyeliner and all that stuff, that was alternative. It wasn't sad. It was like hard. And then it turned, yeah, like our most recent recollection of that as old millennials here is emo, because they're the ones who just like took it all the way.
Mm-hmm.
But alternative to the 1980s, you know, everything in full living color was to go grunge and to go like Nirvana, to go just kind of dark and drab and big and baggy and tattered. It was hard.
Yeah, you were unimpressed by everything.
And punk wasn't about, punk was like, I'm me and this is the way, like it's, like I would,
it was more aggressive.
I would venture to say that Donald Trump's MAGA movement, America First movement, is punk rock. And it might look on the surface the same, you know, punk rock in the music sense might look on the surface the same as emo, because people are wearing, you know, heavy eyeliner and chains and dog collars and whatever it might be. But just because, like, the people who originated that were basically flipping the bird to the man, saying, no, I'm going to do what I want. I'm going to live like I want. Emo is like, oh, I'm so sad. And that's different. The reason
my hair is on my forehead. Flat. It has no life.
Isn't
either.
There a big difference between, like, punk rock and emo?
Yeah.
I mean, there's a positive, there's kind of an extra confident attitude that goes with punk rock. There's no confidence in emo.
It's like, yeah, punk had this anarchist energy and emo had no energy. They just were like, we don't care.
Emo's like the anarchist movement failed.
Yeah, now we're sad. Yeah, now we're sad. This is what we are now.
Blink 182 or Green Day, even before that, they're not sad. They're not. They weren't all up in their feels.
No. But they took punk in a different direction.
I made it popular, not alternative.
Well, I looked up emo bands, and the first one that I always think of is Jimmy Eat World. But I thought I don't know if they're even considered emo. They are. They're on the list.
Yeah.
But here's the two that stuck out to me that I was like, oh yeah, and they suck. My Chemical Romance.
Oh yeah.
What do they sing?
I don't know. And Fall Out Boy.
I can't stand Fall Out Boy.
I can't either.
There's one song they sing that I will tolerate in a stadium.
Now I got to find out what it is.
But the rest of all the other songs, I'm like, stop shouting. You can't shout everything.
I just remember thinking, this is the cheapest, phoniest crap that's packaged to look like an image. But I mean, how much music isn't that? I mean, most music is that.
Libby says, emo, poor me, my parents suck.
I can't find a single song from Fall Out Boy that I recognize. Well, other than
I
We Didn't Start the
Fire.
I
can walk a miracle. That's just how it goes. So actually,
they redid We Didn't Start the Fire a couple years ago, and that was a pretty popular song.
Ender says Fall Out Boy is great.
Okay.
Sorry, Ender. Sorry
about that. Adam Levine.
Sorry about being wrong. Chemical Romance songs. I don't recognize any of these either. Doesn't matter.
I don't think emo started really setting in until the mid-2000s.
Yeah.
Everything leading up to, I mean, I graduated high school in 2002. You graduated in 99 or 2000?
99.
Brad in 2001.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So, like, all that music that we were listening to, that was after the 90s alternative of stuff like Bush and Nirvana, and you know, I would almost stick Green Day in there as well. Like all of that stuff that was alternative to the super electrified pop of the 80s, it became mainstream at the turn of the century, making that alternative rock be popular, just less chords and a little more pep in the step. Kind of the same type of message, but I think that's where punk pop comes in.
By the time we got to 2000, the music scene had splintered out so much that there wasn't any one particular brand of rock that was, this is the thing. Other than, I guess, the Limp Bizkit stuff.
Well, Foo Fighters.
Even then.
They were still going, but they were even mid-90s. Like,
you get like System of a Down at that time, and then, you know, then on the other side of that, you've got like Foo Fighters and Foo Fighters. And
what?
I think he was just doing.
Dave Grohl told a story about how he.
I'm standing here. I'm trying so hard to hang on to this conversation and participate in it, and then that happens.
You
I'm
are
like,
trying hard,
Dave, man. Dave, I don't. Dave well, Grohl, I live this.
Dave
so
Grohl
I know
was
this.
Telling a story about how he got Christopher Walken to mispronounce Foo Fighters at Saturday Night Live. He's like, the emphasis is on the second word. He's like, Christopher Walken comes out there. He's like, and now Foo Fighters.
And your story's derailed.
Yeah.
Were you going somewhere with that?
Yeah, I mean, it was just, it was a splintered rock group, you know, System of a Down, and then you had, like, Foo Fighters and
it's
Lit.
It's Foo
and...
Fighters. that's the one thing I do know in this segment.
Foo Fighters is a band. That's correct. I will say this. I don't like anything Foo Fighters did after their second album, though. Totally side conversation, but their first two albums were awesome. And then after that, and I have posters. Apparently, Dave Grohl will not sign anything anymore except for charity. And I've got a whole poster of the original lineup of the first album.
Why won't he?
I think he just gets hounded so much everywhere he goes that he's like, look, I'll do it, but only if it's for a charitable event and it's got to go through the channels and everything. But I've still got that thing. It's from the original first album with the same first lineup with Pat Smear and everybody on it. It's signed, and I will never let that go. I was so excited when my dad got me that.
Does it bother you that isn't Green Day, are they Canadian?
No.
Mm-hmm.
They are, well, let's find out.
This whole segment has been us Googling things. Google. Somebody says something, two people disagree.
The first sentence from AI, Green Day is an American rock band, not Canadian.
Did they?
Thank you.
Did they sing American Idiot?
Yes.
I think that that's where that came from. My recollection was that there was a story. It's interesting that it says that, because that means that that story has been out there, is that they sang American Idiot and that they were Canadian.
No.
Weird Al made the Canadian Idiot parody of American Idiot, and I think that's probably where that came from.
Man. I listen to music today, and I feel like an old person, because I feel like they're not, when people are singing, they're just lazily talking.
Mm-hmm.
And there are people out there who have real talent. Ariana Grande is somebody who I think has immeasurable talent. And I reluctantly ended up watching Wicked one time. Evelyn wanted to watch it, so I watched it. And I'm like, this is a great movie. I didn't want to like it, but I ended up watching it. And you just realized this woman is incredibly, incredibly talented. Which brings me to my next question for you that we can talk about on the other side of the break. Cynthia Erivo, she was the Wicked Witch in Wicked. Have you heard about the new role she's playing?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
The role of Jesus Christ in Jesus Christ Superstar. Is this a problem? Is this worthy of our conversation time here? Let's talk about it when we come back on the Annie Fry Show. Don't go away. Another podcaster has crossed.
Hi, this is Jill Schlesinger, CBS News business analyst, certified financial planner, and the host of the Jill on Money podcast. This is the show where your money is not scary. It's a show that's all about you. It's your questions that make it possible for me to provide unconventional and entertaining insights on your money, and more importantly, on your life. Listen and follow Jill on Money on the Odyssey app or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to the Annie Fry Show. So this was a story that came out a while ago. There was an announcement that Cynthia Erivo was going to be featured as the lead, I suppose. Have you ever seen Jesus Christ Superstar?
Yeah, I have. I used to own the soundtrack. I liked it.
Is it a good show?
Yeah, it's pretty good.
What do I need to know as someone who's never seen Jesus Christ Superstar? As a Christian, and there's a play, what's...
So
the connection there.
So Jesus Christ Superstar came out, I think, of what they called the Jesus movement of the early 70s. It was not irreverent, but it was you know, progressive in a way. There was nothing theologically inappropriate about it. Somebody will probably fight me on that, but I never found anything that I found to be terribly suspicious.
I mean,
in
it's not
the
like
original.
It's been put out there to like replace scripture.
No, it was just a new, a 70s take on Jesus and the biblical gospel story. And it was lots of music, lots of songs, pretty well-known songs, actually. The overture is really good. I don't know. It's just, it was kind of a cultural phenomenon in the 70s is probably the best way to describe it. But that there's nothing terribly biblically inaccurate about it.
My favorite plays is Joseph and the Amazing Technicolor Dreamcoat. It's the story of Joseph.
Yeah.
And 1996 or 1997, I went to Chicago Theater to see Donny Osmond, who starred in Joseph the Amazing Technicolor Dreamcoat, because my cousin, very talented, was in the children's chorus that sings along with it. So I got to go see my cousin, and it was really an amazing experience and really cool that he got to do that. And Donny Osmond did great. Now, they take artistic liberties in telling the story of Joseph, but when people leave that play, they know more about a Bible story than they did going into it.
Yeah, that's what most stories are like from the Bible. You have to take artistic liberty. Even The Chosen does. And people love that. You have to do it if you're going to tell the story. You can't do it exactly. Otherwise, it's too dry. You have to tell a story using the Bible as the source material.
Well, I don't know if you've seen a lot of the coverage of this or if you know anything about Cynthia Erivo. She is, if you're unfamiliar with that name, she is the woman who played the Wicked Witch in Wicked, the green one. Very talented actress. I don't think you can deny that. The Daily Wire has an article out on this written by Amanda Harding. And the headline is Intentional Blasphemy. Internet reacts to Cynthia Erivo as Jesus in Jesus Christ Superstar. Subheadline, God will not be mocked. She writes, several clips of actress Cynthia Erivo performing as Jesus Christ in the stage production Jesus Christ Superstar have been circulating online, with many viewers taking a negative view of that particular casting decision. One embedded tweet that they have here has a video of Cynthia Erivo singing, and the tweet is from Mary. It says, Cynthia Erivo plays Jesus in the Jesus Christ Superstar. I want to know, why does this feel evil? Why does her left hand feel as if it's a demonic claw? And then there's pictures on here of it. Do you think that the portrayal of Jesus Christ as a black woman, is it wrong? Does it offend your Christian faith?
Yeah, it does. It's deliberately irreverent. There's nothing reverent about doing that. It's deliberately an artistic choice to kind of inflame people. And if they didn't mess with the source material very much, like, I mean, the script of Jesus Christ Superstar, then I'm sure the message is probably still there. I haven't seen this production. I've just seen, like, you know, clips of it.
It's just in the news.
Yeah, it's just there. But I wouldn't want to go see that. I want to see something that, as a Christian, I just want to do things that bring me closer to God in general. And I just don't think this is going to do that. And I don't even think that's the point of doing this. I do wish that, even if you're not a Christian, I get that your audience may not be Christians. That's okay. But even if your audience is not Christian, you have to consider the way Christians are going to, you can't just take a dump on people's religion. And that's what a lot of progressives like to do in the name of art. And it usually comes out pretty poor.
Another person from this Daily Wire article was quoted to say, they mock faith for applause. Cynthia Erivo plays Jesus, wears the crown, gets praised like it's progress. Try pulling that with any other religion. They'd burn Hollywood to the ground overnight. So Adam Lambert, a huge star out of American Idol from years past, ended up fronting Queen.
Mm-hmm.
Just an incredible singing talent. According to this Daily Wire article, said Lambert addressed the backlash to Erivo's casting, telling Billboard that, quote, Jesus Christ Superstar is meant to provoke and challenge. He said, quote, I'm excited by the challenge of presenting the audience with a production led by a female black Jesus and encourage the audience to expand their minds a bit. And shouldn't the teachings of Jesus transcend gender?
Well, not really, no. I mean, Jesus was very clear about what his teachings were. We don't have to go see some new interpretation of them. We know what they were.
They're not confined by gender. Like, this is not, it's not like Jesus's teachings were in a box until Cynthia Erivo and Adam Lambert and the Hollywood Bowl came by and were like, let's make this so other people can now access it.
Their statement there, too, is implying, but I don't think that they're really trying to do this, that they're just trying to get you to understand Jesus in a new way. That is not what they're trying to do. They're trying to change your understanding of Jesus and try to basically, I don't know if mock is the right word, but distort.
Distort.
They're trying to distort it to where it makes it less... It makes it less important.
You listen to that comment, and that comment comes from somebody that doesn't necessarily believe that, like, the way they make that comment, they don't believe that Jesus was a real historical figure. This is, like, Jesus is a religious figure, so it's a part of a mythology or whatever. So there's, like, and in that room you have the artistic thing. As a Christian, I look at this and I say, no, Jesus was historically real. He was a real man that walked the earth. He was real. You don't get to rewrite history because you want to challenge people. This is true.
And I'll add, too, that I actually like artistic interpretations of basically everything. If you want to approach even the biblical account...
Hamilton. The entire Hamilton story is putting black people in the position of our founding fathers, and just because their skin is black doesn't change the message of the story the way it is told. I mean, I've watched Hamilton, and historically, other than the skin color of the actor, the story is still the same. I hesitated on seeing Hamilton because the initial stories from conservative media come out and they're like, oh, they've made it woke and blah, blah, blah. And then I ended up watching and I'm like, that was amazing. Hamilton is great. And the fact that they make the person a black person, I actually think, is an enormous testament to the story of America. That in this time, you can put a black person in there and people are like, yeah.
I mean, it's a great example of how far we've come.
Is it different when it's Jesus?
Yeah,
and
it is.
And honestly, folks, key top A1 point. Jesus wasn't white.
Mm-mm.
Yeah, that's true. And you always have to ask, what's the intention of the writer or producer or whoever is putting on the production, whether it be a stage play or a movie or a book or whatever. I just don't get the sense that these are people who are like, we want to look at Jesus in a new way because we think that that will be helpful to everybody. That we think that Christians will even benefit from looking at this through a new lens. I brought up The Chosen. I still have not really watched that show in depth, but I know a lot of people who love that show. And do you guys hate that show? I have no idea.
I know somebody who's obsessed with The Chosen.
Oh, really?
They know who
they are. I haven't watched it.
But there, as far as I understand it, there are a lot of liberties that they take in that show that we don't really know if Jesus said this or that here. We know that the scene is generally this, but we don't know exactly how this played out. So they take some liberties. That's great, because their purpose in doing so is to give you a richer understanding of when Jesus walked this earth, how this story could have played out, and what he was like. We don't know if he was exactly like that, but he might have been, and it might have been, might shine a different light.
And it's adiaphora. It's a part of the story that they're putting in there that doesn't change the salvation story.
Correct.
It's an artistic contribution that could bring people more into an understanding of who Jesus was, but more important, what Jesus is.
And here's just taking from what they're doing to Jesus Christ Superstar here, consider what if somebody approached the biblical account and said, let's take the biblical account, Jesus, all the characters, and put them into like modern day Rwanda. You'd go, well, I don't know what that is, but that sounds interesting. How would that impact the world today? What would that look like? To me, that's artistic expression of using it. If, as long as you're doing it with some reverence, with some respect, you could get something out of that, maybe. This, to me, just doesn't look like it has any of those earmarks.
The litmus test for me on anything like this, and the reason I bring it up, and I haven't really like weighed in my thoughts on it, one of two things happens. It glorifies God, or it does not. Mm-hmm. And if it doesn't glorify God, then it glorifies the antithesis of God. There is good, that's God. There is evil, that's everything else. If the intention here is not to shine, and like, folks, also, it's not like this is the one example of Hollywood where, like, I don't know if they're glorifying God here.
Right.
Like, let's let's look at what the
we're trying to give them a lot of deference.
Yeah.
And say, maybe, I don't know, but
because Jesus is a part of this. If you're looking at, you don't have to look very far. Let's just go back one more time real quick here to Adam Lambert, who's starring as Judas. You know, we can look at the visuals of this. You can see Cynthia Erivo. You can make your own judgment. She puts herself out there for people. She's a public figure. You get to make a judgment. That's part of the thing. Cynthia Erivo is probably happy if you're talking about her. Good or bad, if you're talking, she's relevant. And she certainly is. She's an incredible actress. But when Adam Lambert says, I'm excited by the challenge of presenting the audience with a production led by a female black Jesus and encourage the audience to expand their minds a bit. And shouldn't the teachings of Jesus transcend gender? Does that point the spotlight on Christ, on your Christian faith, or does it point the spotlight away from it? Because I don't think you need I don't think you could have a more clear statement from somebody very closely involved in this, that if you're asking about, because it's Jesus Christ Superstar, they chose to do this. They wanted to take a risk and push the envelope in this regard. And then they chose further, you know, we're going to do this play, but not only are we going to do this play, watch and see what we do with it. Does it glorify God? And if it obviously doesn't, what else is there to say? But again, to the point we made just before I started making this one, you could ask that question about everything that comes out of Hollywood, and you should. Quick break. We'll be right back. Don't go away. By the
bathroom, you said let's talk. It's going to triple by 2060, as you said. To give you an idea, it was 2 million metric tons back in the 1950s. And out of 16,000 chemicals that are in all of this, at least a third of those have active chemicals in them. And we're talking about bisphenol A, we're talking about phthalates, we're talking about vinyl chloride, but literally hundreds and hundreds of active chemicals in our bodies in the form of microplastics. Endocrine disruptors, I just mentioned, that interfere with fertility. We're finding a teaspoonful of plastics in our brains, our hearts. I've talked to top cardiologists who believe it's directly related to heart disease, to causing heart disease. We got to do something about this. And there's a global plastics treaty that's being negotiated right now in Geneva. But I'll tell you the problem, Jillian. Some countries are resisting, and it's likely not to have any teeth because of oil-producing countries like Saudi Arabia, where the plastics come directly from fossil fuels, of course. So there's a big debate and a big back and forth over this, but the plastics are doing tremendous damage to human health, as RFK Jr. says.
Dr.
I completely agree with him on this.
Siegel talking about the plastics that have infiltrated our bodies. He said you have a teaspoon of microplastics in your brain. Explains it. Some of us might have more.
You guys might.
That should have been the poll today. Who does it seem like has the most microplastics in their brain?
And who seems like they have the most macroplastics in their brain? And then you get two polls.
You big macroplastic guy?
I love macros. Hate the micros.
Does it freak you out to think about all that?
Yeah, it does, because I don't know what to think about it or what to do about it. It sounds like we do have people in office now who are broaching the topic. And I'm like, okay, that's probably good, but I still don't know what they're gonna. I mean, if you come up with some multinational solution to the problem, like, hey, great, didn't know you could do that.
The thing about it that freaks me out the most is that I'm paying attention to it, but I don't know anything. And yeah. I'm always worried about, like, this, I'm primed to be sold.
Me too.
Like, someone's like, oh, you gotta do this, blah, blah, blah. And in 5 years, they're gonna be like, that very thing that I started doing is what's killing me now.
Yeah. Yeah, just like, you shouldn't drink hot car. You know, if a water bottle's been in the car for a long time, it's going to have a lot more microplastics
in
it.
And that's super interesting.
And you're that
this has come along, because there's two people in my family that have had cancer, and they attribute it to plastics.
Who's they? Who attributes it?
The people that had the cancer.
Okay, they do.
So the one drank coffee out of the same mug for 30 years. And it was just a plastic, you know, travel mug. Put their coffee in it, away they go. The other one would refill plastic water
bottles. But there's no way to know that that's what caused it.
They don't know it, but, like, where the cancers were and that sort of thing. I guess you could, they haven't had the test, but that's what they suspect.
Does it? Do you do anything about it? I know I have people in my family who have replaced plastic storage ware in their fridge. Like they put their food in a glass bowl. It's got a wood top.
I haven't done a thing about it because I don't know what to do. Because like you said, in 5 years, you're going to go, oh, it wasn't that thing. It was this thing.
Isn't it wild, though, to look at like old timey pictures and see everybody's thin?
Yeah. Have you thought, though, because and maybe you're looking at different ones than I am, but when they bring up those pictures from, oh, look at this is 1974 on the beach and everybody's thin. And it's like, well, yeah, but it's also just one spot, one day on the beach. And you're on the beach where people like to show off their bodies, so you might get more thin people. I'm not saying we haven't gained...
They'll show like walking downtown New York.
Yeah, I'm not saying we haven't gained a lot of weight as a society. Clearly, our obesity numbers are off the charts compared to what they used to be.
They got a picture, they got a shot right now at the United Nations in New York. And if you're looking out there, most people that you see are not slim. That doesn't mean that they're obese by any means, but the body shape of Americans today is vastly different than it was in the 1950s.
Mm-hmm. Part of it is that we just don't move around that much. Because I don't think it's just food related. I think it's that we are pretty sedentary.
Yeah, I mean, it's the part of it. I always hear people say, like, you can't outwork a bad diet. That, I mean, even if you were out there hustling, bustling, if you're eating crap, it doesn't matter. But when we start hearing about plastics in our body and we start hearing about these toxins that are inflaming all of our systems, it's hard to beat. It's hard to get ahead of. X's and Y's in the next segment. Don't go away. Next hour.
Hi, this is Jill Schlesinger, CBS News business analyst, certified financial planner, and the host of the Jill on Money podcast. This is the show where your money is not scary. It's a show that's all about you. It's your questions that make it possible for me to provide unconventional and entertaining insights on your money, and more importantly, on your life. Listen and follow Jill on Money on the Odyssey app or wherever you get your podcasts.